The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Panel today, Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity School of Biochemistry and Immunology. Susan Daly is Managing Editor of the Journal.ie and Jim Power is an economist. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Luke, you don't want to be the one. We were all young and they've had a rough time and everything. You don't want to be the one pooping their party. But the scenes, you've seen the video, have you?
I have.
What are your thoughts on those scenes? They are outdoors, I suppose.
That's the good thing. That's the free, as we know, Brendan, in spades, now outdoors is great. I think Tony saw a miasma of virus hanging over that crowd. I bet that was in his mind, you know?
Yeah.
A huge.
Did you see that when you looked at it?
A huge, dense crowd of people, and it's not great, you know, for a protracted period of time. We know the virus spreads in crowds. That's the bottom line, you know?
Yeah.
And the bigger the crowd and the longer time together, there is a risk of the virus spreading. On the other hand, I agree, people are going to behave in this way.
But I feel in a way, is this our fault? Because society has not offered these kids an alternative.
That's
we
right.
said outdoor summer, pedestrianise the streets, there you go. What else are they going to do?
But if it all moved out a bit and spaced out, that would have better, you know? So maybe there should have been people there trying to corral them in some way or encourage them to split up a bit. But that dense crowd is definitely a risk.
Yeah, well, the Gardaí were there and they say there were no incidents. Large crowds around the city centre throughout the day, but they've been peaceful. And Gardaí were using, like you say, were encouraging. The Gardaí were using the four E's, engage, explain, encourage and enforce. So, well, there you go. Susan Daly, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I saw Tony Holohan's tweet before I saw the videos, I think, like most people did. And I have to say, you know, the tone did strike me as, oh, crikey, Tony's a little bit upset here, and it feels a little bit like he's lecturing to people. And then I saw the videos, and I can't lie, I have to say the anxiety crept up very quickly from my toes to the top of my head. And even thinking about them now, I had a look again this morning, my skin was crawling with
the
idea.
Seeing that miasma,
I'm seeing
virus
the miasma,
as well,
I'm feeling
Susan.
It, I'm taking a cold shower. I'm telling you, it didn't look great. What I will say, if you kind of, I mean, the other thing is I do feel it's both understandable, both his rage, both people's reaction to him on Twitter, I think, as well, simply because people are just tired. And then the third part of it, you can understand how people congregated in that way. Look how beautiful it was. Look at the message we were getting on Friday from the government. I mean, it really felt like, crikey, guys, we're really getting here. It's nearly all open. You can do this on this date. We're looking even at international travel. So there's a bit of a messaging situation here. So I think we need to move away from what those people specifically, and they weren't all young. There were plenty of people there, and I consider myself young in my 40s. Thank you very much. Like, there were a few people matching my kind of age in there as well. And I do think that what it underlined for me, so Tony Holohan's reaction and maybe our reaction to it, is that what people are thinking about as their normality is very, very different. It underlines that we all have different things that will make us feel like we're going back to normal. I had my normality yesterday in a friend's back garden in the sunshine where my kids were playing with their kids, which I can tell you after 18 months of like literally having, you know, we were very careful about our kids and so on. Just this idea that they were distracted by another human being the same size as them was for me, wow, this feels amazing. For people yesterday who had a drink and were there, that's what made them feel amazing. And I think that what it shows us is we're not ready for this outdoor summer that the government is saying we should have. And I'm keeping Neffet out of this because really their job is to kind of go this on a purely medical level and public health I'm terrified of. I think that is their job and I think we shouldn't personalise it. But I do think that there's been not enough thought about what an outdoor summer looks like. We saw this with the outdoor toilets. We saw it with them just saying we'd close Portobello Plaza because we don't know what else to do. This isn't limited to Dublin. We've seen incidents in Cork and Galway, and it's not just been this weekend, and it's because people haven't been given a proper alternative. The alternative to inside is outside, and the alternative to outside being managed properly is not to let these situations build up. South William Street was in the news, by the way, in the week, because people were pointing out the so-called pedestrianisation is only a small amount of it because of this car park entrance exit sort of situation.
Yeah.
And then there's a more studied version of that happening. We have a story on it on the Journal this morning by Ola Dwyer. And it shows that there's been a lot of consultation and research put into how Merrion Row and Hume Street and that area around the top of Stephen's Green is going to work, because they have a lot of outside activities going to be happening there with dining and drinking and so on. And they had a huge public consultation. They got a 93% approval rate of the plans. They consulted with residents. I mean, they're going to be most impacted by this. So, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of work has to go into this stuff to not recreate those scenes.
I think, Susan, particularly if you are a trader in that area who's not selling jugs of takeaway cocktails or whatever. And actually, I'm joined now by Martin Denyo. And Martin is the owner of the Monte Cristo shop in Powers Court. And Martin, the video we've been talking about, that was your video doing the rounds on social media last night.
Yes, that's when I came out of work yesterday at 8 o'clock in the evening, standing on the steps of Powers Court Town Centre on South William Street.
And what was the scene?
What was the scene? Well, there was a sea of people dancing and boozing and partying. I was flabbergasted. And there was no police around. There were a few cars trying to make their way through the crowd very, very slowly. I was flabbergasted. So I did what people do when their mind goes blank. I took out my phone, and the young fellow beside me, a tall guy, he told me, "Oh, I'm taller than you. I'll take the video for you." So he did take the video with my phone of the surroundings.
Well, like, were they good natured in general then, Martin, the revelers, as so called?
I'd say most of them, yes, were. There was a lot of canisters of gas, I think some kind of drug that young people use all over the floor, and a lot of them may have been quite high.
Oh, is this what the balloons were? Yeah.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. Okay.
When I went through the crowd, one young fellow gave out to me, and I didn't understand immediately, but then I understood that he was giving it to me because I was wearing a mask, and I realized that no one else was wearing a mask. There wasn't one mask in the crowd.
Okay. Now, Martin, you say that you saw no police there. We have a longer statement here from Garda Síochána, and they're saying they continue to appeal to the public to avoid crowded areas and large gatherings. They say that the Gardaí have and will continue to adopt a graduated policing response based on its tradition of policing by consent. This has seen the Gardaí, as we say, engage, educate, encourage, and only as a last resort enforce. What would you like to see happen?
Well, as a trader and as a member of a group of traders in the area, mostly retailers, it's called Dublin Can Be Heaven, we would like to see Dublin City Council actually manage the pedestrianisation they've orchestrated. So they've blocked the street, stopped cars from coming through, but they're not managing it. They're not maintaining it. They're not cleaning it. They're not polishing it. This is what we would like to see, because we're losing our customers.
Okay, Martin, thank you very much. And I'm going to talk now to Mary Whelan of the Dublin Can Be Heaven group that you mentioned there. And Mary, you're also the owner of Heirloom Shop on Stephen Street. Now, this is not the first weekend that this has happened, has it? Because someone was telling me they were in town last week, and that from very early in the afternoon it was starting to get a bit messy. Is that right, Mary?
That's right, Brendan. This has been going on for a long time now. I mean, this dates back to last year, where we saw weekend revelry. Now, you can't blame the young people. They're obviously desperately in need of socialisation. But last night really saw the what we regard as the absolute mismanagement of Dublin City Council sink to an all-time low. And there's over 65 members in our group, and honestly, you know, the phones lit up last night.
And so how do you propose they manage it? What would you like to see, Mary?
Well, first of all, consultation with the traders. They say that they have conducted, you know, in-depth studies and surveys. They haven't. This isn't true. They put out what we regard as propaganda in terms of the successful nature of.
Okay. Well, look, I'm sure that's a matter of opinion. So let's not get into that too much. But in terms of what could have been done to manage the situation yesterday.
Well, first of all, one of the things that we've been asking for a long time is public toilets. And what we see on the streets every weekend are people urinating all over the place. It's become really unsavoury. We've been asking for public toilets. The only ones that have been provided are the ones outside the Stephen's Green Centre on the green there. You'll always see long, long queues of people waiting for them.
And are the pubs where people are getting the takeaway drink, are they allowing them to use the toilets there, or are people just using the street?
They're using the street because the pubs actually aren't supposed to allow them inside to use their toilets. I know one or two pubs are, simply because they feel it's their duty to do so, but on the whole, they're not actually supposed to allow them into the premises to use the toilets.
Okay.
So when you look at a cause and effect situation, you know, you invite people into the city to drink and you provide no facilities for them. I mean, okay. A child could see how that's going to end up.
All right. Thanks a million, Mary Whelan, owner of Heirlooms on Stephen Street. Jim, I'd be very reluctant to get into suddenly pointing the finger at these kids and as Susan says, some older people, that this is the latest group we demonise now or whatever. And also, you know, I think we all accept young people need to do what young people do, and they've had a time of it and they've been very compliant in general. But it does sound as if we're not managing this situation very well, are we?
Well, I guess there's one level, Brendan. I think the best years of people's lives are sort of between 18 and 30. That's your point of ultimate freedom, where you have a little bit of money, you're out of school. And basically, that age group has had 18 months effectively almost taken away from them.
You have two lads at home in that
position. I have two lads, 23 and 26.
And how have they gone on?
They've gone on okay, but you can see the frustration. You can see their lives have basically been put on hold. They haven't been able to go out. They haven't been able to socialise. They haven't been able to engage in sport or very little. So their lives have been seriously disrupted. And it's terrible to see for that age group, as I say, 10 to 15% of the best years of their lives being effectively taken away from them. And I don't think there's anything that could be done to prevent what happened last night. It was a nice evening. Regardless of whether there's indoor, outdoor, whatever the arrangements are, I think given the opportunity, people will. And I've seen it in the local parks. I've seen kids congregating all over the place. And I suppose...
I think people felt it was very, very tight street in that video compared to parks around the place
It was incredibly tight, but we've seen events like that in South William Street weeks ago. Yeah. Was there a surge of infection resulting from that, or indeed from the protests we've seen in town for various things over the last few months?
Yeah, look, there wasn't really, was there?
No.
Yeah. That's the trouble, Ben. There's not much science to say what happened last night will cause a big rise in infections, for example.
Yeah.
But we know it was a risky thing to do. But I agree with Jim entirely. These young people want to do this. You know, in my opinion, we've a race now to get the vaccine out. It's the same old story again. If you're over 18 and you're vaccinated, you're going to be protected, and then you can gather in crowds. That's the real solution, by the way. Yeah. Any other kind of policing seems difficult, doesn't it? Those things seem challenging.
Susan, I'm not going to act all innocent. No, I've half an idea what those canisters are, but can you give us what they actually are?
I don't know why you're going to me on this, Brendan, as if...
But you're about the youngest person we have here, so you're closest to
I'm probably within 2 decades of throwing a stone at this, so it's not that great a thing. No, there is, I mean, look, I can't say specifically the things that we saw, because in the video there are people with balloons, so just to be very clear, those lads could be just waving balloons around, we don't know. There is a thing though where nitrous oxide, that's what you'll see in gas cartridges, and they're sort of it's the stuff that you would use, say, if you were in the dentist, you were being sedated, so it's not you know, horse tranquilizer stuff exactly, but it is, you know, it causes a few minutes of euphoria. It hits very quickly, but it can be extremely dangerous, you know, particularly if overused. And what they do is the discharge the cartridge into another object, so that, because it's obviously quick release or whatever. So a balloon is an obviously quick way to catch gas, if you think about it. And then it allows you to sort of take a breath here and there, whatever, without losing it all into the air, sort of thing. Again, I will say this is my research. I have absolutely never done this myself. But you know what? That was, I just saw that was just happened to be at the tail end of one of those videos. I don't think, just to give a good, like to give a proper impression of what was there last night.
They weren't all there with balloons in every orifice in their body. Absolutely. No, just, I'm more curious than kind of being censorious about it. But you'd wonder, is it technically illegal, or is it one of those things that's actually not illegal? But it still is odd.
It's the misuse, certainly, of a thing. And the thing is that
you've got this open air thing going on where people are liberally taking balloons to get high and stuff, and the guards are saying
it did look a little festival. It did, to be fair. And I do feel that we were all on a bit of a, well, not that kind of a high, but a bit of a high yesterday after the Friday announcement. On the Saturday morning, I actually took my 2-year-old to meet a few little kids. She's in a special group that we used to meet a lot before the pandemic, and you know, travelled to a park and met them, and we all had our separate blankets. But the kids were, you know, rolling around with each other and stuff. And I was like, oh, you know, none of us are vaccinated yet. We're not. They haven't got to us yet. So I agree with Luke that this is what people's eye on is now. Mm. And then we hear that there's a slowdown, and you know, God, the Janssen thing is not going to happen the way we thought it would. You know, I think all of that makes people a little worried. Breen McCraw, who's the vaccines are, he's in the Sunday Business Post today with a little bit of an interview, and he talked about, you know, Pfizer has really been the only one that's been reliable for us in bringing the goods, because everything else is a little, you know, is there an issue with AstraZeneca? The Moderna's been fine, solid enough in terms of the numbers coming in, but it hasn't added any extra. And then obviously the Johnson & Johnson, we had such disappointment with that. So I think we really have to think about, I'm concerned about the opening myself, because I do think that I'm in the same position I was 2 months ago, you know.
But Brendan, I found it interesting in the Brian McCraw interview in the Sunday Business Post that Susan has mentioned. He was citing the statistics that 2% of new cases over the last 14 days have been for people aged over 65. So the vaccine program is working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
70% of infections are people under 45, and yet hospitalizations and ICU numbers are falling. So, and this is the UK experience with the Indian variant as well.
This is the breakage of the link between cases and hospitalisation.
That would appear to be the case. I'm not a scientist or an epidemiologist, but it just strikes me.
So you're tentatively suggesting that we could possibly live with what is technically a fourth wave over the summer, which might be inevitable, that cases go up.
I think
up.
We may have to, absolutely. Yeah. I don't think there's any choice.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Every day the data on these vaccines grows. I mean, it's an amazing thing. 1.84 billion people have now had one shot of a vaccine. This is the best, most successful vaccination campaign in history. It's remarkable, you know. And then in Ireland, we're up to 2.6 million now. 20% are fully vaccinated. These are tremendous numbers. The HSE actually deserves credit, but they're always getting kicked. I mean, it's been a fantastic vaccination campaign.
Yeah,
so
I think everyone has kind of changed their attitude now and decided that it's actually going quite well, isn't it?
And the only worry is supply. That's the last remain. There's two worries we have now. The supply chain breaking for some reason. Now, Pfizer are playing gangbusters. It's fantastic. I mean, they're going to start making in Ireland, which is tremendous, by the way. And then the variants, of course. They're the two remaining scientific concerns we have, really.
Yeah, I actually wonder, in a year's time, is AstraZeneca going to be over?
It might be from the marketing departments, by the way, because you see there's obviously advantages to some. Now, remember, AstraZeneca is still a very efficacious, successful vaccine.
I wonder, will it be going to the developing world? It probably will do. And Pfizer will be the first world.
And that'll snap it up a bit.
Luke, I thought, I want to talk about your piece in today's paper in a minute, but you made some comments on Friday, I think it was, about the opening up. And you're known for being a very positive person. I thought that you weren't as fully positive as you normally are. You said this reopening is a work in progress, and there's a note of caution there with you.
slight. We don't know what's going to happen with this. The bee, famous now, it's the B16172, which is now in the UK. Every day I'm looking at those numbers. I mean, there's increased hospitalizations in the north of England, for example, probably because of this variant, you see. And now we watch to see if that becomes severe disease. That's the thing we're watching for now. So far, so good, though, by the way. The vaccines do seem to stop that progressing into severe disease, even that variant, the latest.
So, and to be clear, the 33%, for example, that we heard, if you have one shot of AstraZeneca, that is against any symptomatic disease.
That's just risk of infection. That's all that is, you see. So far, so good. In that, and I've had, I was on Friday, I took part in a wonderful thing. The Indian ambassador to Ireland asked me to take part in a big debate about India. Yeah. There's a company called Covaxin over there. They're making the vaccine for India. They say their vaccine's working against
This is another vaccine the Serum Institute making, the AstraZeneca.
It's their own vaccine. And they say they're going to make 1 billion doses. And they published data at 78% efficacious. And they're saying it should work against the B1617. If that's true, the others will work as well. You know, so there's a bit more optimism, actually, that the vaccine should stop progression. But the reason why I express
what
caution...
What aspect of the opening up are you kind of a bit cautious about?
It's the speed of it. I mean, the next 3 or 4 weeks are critical. So if in the UK we see increased severe disease from that new variant, then we have to be, hang on a minute, let's just slow it down slightly, which we can do. The Taoiseach has said we can respond to the data as it comes.
And it would just be a question of slowing down a few weeks while we get more vaccine.
Essentially. Israel are very telling. Israel, once they'd reached 70% being fully vaccinated, right, with the two shots, then they opened up much more, you know. So they waited to reach that 70% threshold of the double shots, basically.
Yeah.
We should possibly be similarly cautious and just get the double shots out as quick as we can.
Jim, do you think we're being a bit reckless here?
No, I don't. I think it's necessary to reopen socially, economically, and particularly from the perspective of mental health. I just think it is needed as we move into the summer. Clearly, and the Taoiseach said it, and Lucas said it there, you know, if the facts change, we can manipulate it a little bit. We can try and direct it. But the secret seems to be to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible. And as we move down the age groups, you'd hope that the illness and the severity of illness will decrease significantly. Yeah. So... But definitely, it is a work in progress, and we've just got to see how it works.
Susan, are you uneasy about any aspects of it?
Yeah, again, it is the speed. It may be that I'm institutionalised by how long we have been sort of ploughing our own furrows in our own homes and so on. But definitely, with the weather, you feel like you're battling between this emotional need to see people as quickly as possible and so on. And then the other side of it, I did say, and I'm coming, as most people are, from a self-centred place where I'm going, I haven't had my first shot yet. And so while, you know, I'm delighted my mother has just had her too and will be seeing her very soon. Hi, ma'am. She's down the country. There is this sense that a week or two, all of a sudden, there seems to be this pressure that if we don't open by this date, or if we, like, if you look at the government guidelines about how things are going to reopen, I was actually kind of heartened to see that in June they have, okay, on this date, this will happen. In July, they have a proviso on it saying, if things are going the way they should be. And I think that that's the way we should be approaching this for sure, because it's a bit like if you look at any, and we've been knee deep in disinformation and misinformation in the journal for the last year and a bit with our fact check project. And one of the things that kind of makes people feel like they're not being told the truth or whatever is like they can pull out a quote from 6 months ago and say, well, they were saying this then, or they didn't recommend masks at the very start. But it's like, as Luke will know, it's a novel, like it's in the name. Yeah. It's a new thing.
It's an unfolding situation.
It's unfolding. We're learning something new each time. And Brendan, you mentioned in the headlines of the papers this morning, a piece from Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Independent. And I thought that piece you picked up on halfway down was really interesting, which was the Dublin Airport Authority's data analyst running some figures on if we opened international travel, for example. And there's a lot of things in that that is really to do with practicalities that you kind of go, yeah, we're not all going to be heading to the Canaries by the end of the summer, and we need to mentally adjust to that. So something like, there's even more detail on the online version of it, that when they ran it, now Dublin Airport would have had traditionally 60,000 people travelling through every day, okay? That's not what they're aiming for. But if there's an estimated hourly maximum demand of about 2,200 passengers going through. The data analyst ran it, and with everything in place, so presuming you'd spot checks on the digital COVID certificates that they're talking about, that e-gates are reopened and so on, that we'd only be able to cope with 700 passengers in total process per hour in Terminal 1, and that they'd be looking at in excess of 10 hours queues building in Terminal 1 over the course of a day.
Yeah.
Now, that to me seems like something we need to, like, again, it's like everything else. It's all up for grabs. And what's not good is when people are playing political football. And this is both within the government, who's saying to the opposition, oh, you wanted a lockdown 6 months ago. And certain opposition parties doing the same.
The government are saying to the opposition, you were demanding mandatory hotel quarantine for everywhere.
Yeah.
And this was weeks ago, in fairness. And now you've turned around and started complaining about connectivity. I mean, I don't think they're exactly going into ancient history there.
Not exactly, but there is the same happening on the other side as well. And I'm probably not going to stand and defend any particular political party spokesperson, because they are all looking at elections in, like, what, a year and a half or something. And you could see Dublin Bay South, there's a lot of that going on at the moment with that. If you're into politics, are very excited about it. But the thing about it again is, like, what is happening now? Is it to do with this is the safest, and also taking into account that we need the economy to start recovering a bit? Or is there a little bit of political wanting to get that bounce that they've seen Boris Johnson get in the UK? That fella can do no wrong. Like, I don't know what people... Dominic Cummins was there. He's been former spin doctor during the week. Now, he doesn't have much credibility, but he was basically
Shane
damning
Ross
him.
Said today, Boris Johnson is very lucky in his enemies in general, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, on the travel thing, Jim, you've picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday there by Valerie Handy and Isabel Conrad. Go big or stay home. New jet setters get ready for a trip of a lifetime. I was only talking to Maureen Gaffney yesterday, and we were agreeing this is not the time for a trip of a lifetime. You could go somewhere familiar and somewhere where you're, you know, feel safe and relaxed and stuff. Did you pick that piece, Jim? You're looking...
Yeah, I did. And... The piece about people not traveling overseas, not going on the big holiday, staycation. I hate the term staycation, but that's the term that's being used. But some of the prices that are being cited or quoted for Airbnb
in Ireland,
In Clifton, Kinsale were two that were mentioned in that article. Absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you're talking about $4,500 for 6 nights. I mean, it's extraordinary stuff. So, if that sort of trend takes over, it's really, really going to create serious problems. And I think that is just going to exacerbate the pressure for people to get up and leave the country, regardless of the safety consequences.
But I suppose if you've an Airbnb that you have a mortgage on, and you have made you've made maybe a month or 6 weeks worth of business in the last year, that's what Airbnb...
Oh, of course it is. I can see why it's been done. But on the other hand, would I pay $4,500 for 6 nights in an Airbnb in Ireland? No, I would not.
You get some holiday abroad.
Absolutely, you get some holiday abroad. Yeah.
Okay, listen, there's a lot of people on either side of the... that whole discussion about South Great George's Street and stuff. An innovative solution here from Mary, who texts 51551 to say, would there not be a few shuttle buses on hand to pick up the revellers in the city centre, dump them around various areas in the Phoenix Park, and then bring them back later when they're exhausted and all the yahooing is spent? I'd say Luke can picture the miasma of the virus in those shuttle buses. But I think there is an idea there of, like, Should there be an attempt to spread out this kind of thing, and, you know, spread out bloody... I've always thought, buy thousands of picnic tables and spread them out around places around the country. Email from Chris to Brendan at RT.ie. Stop saying poor young people have suffered. Everyone have suffered. Old folk have a limited few years left. That's absolutely true. Another texter here. Don't know why everyone's surprised. It was exactly the same last weekend. And here's the point. Next weekend is a bank holiday.
Yeah.
The party, in inverted commas, will last 3 days. And if this weather stays with us, I think it's going to change during the week, but if it's going to stay with us in general, this is going to go on and on. And just one more email from Ellen. I had occasion to drive to Drury Street, South William Street, half an hour ago. What I saw was absolutely shocking, with mounds of bottles, cans, debris strewn all over the place. And indeed, there are videos up of the mess there this morning. Even two cyclists hit some of the piles of debris on their cycle. I saw a man, presumably from Dublin City Authorities, trying to pick up the debris left behind. And that's another thing. Why aren't there bins everywhere? Why aren't there big plastic bags on frames all over the place? But like the bloody outdoor summer, we went on and on about it, but we were not ready. Okay, our panel staying with us, Professor Luke O'Neill, Susan Daly and Jim Power. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Just want to read you two more texts. This is interesting. Hi, Brendan. It's become increasingly clear that when the government says outdoor summer, what they're thinking of is middle-class people in four-bedroomed houses enjoying a balmy afternoon in their gardens. There's no plan for the vast majority of people who don't have access to those facilities, and I don't know what else they expected to happen. And just one more, a mother of two young adults in Kilkenny emailed to say, I've lived my life. Leave the youth alone. Last night was pent-up youthful exuberance. Why did they not factor all this into a plan? Should manage this situation and consultation with the Gardaí. Stop blaming young people every time there's a big gathering. I'm 56, a mother of two young adults. And she says again, Kay in Kilkenny, I've lived my life. Leave the youth alone.
Here, here.
That, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Brendan, can I come in on that,
Susan,
actually?
Yeah.
I thought there was a great point there. And it, but from both of them. And it was the thing that I kind of mentioned at the top of this was the divergence of people's personal experience on what normality is and what's going to feel good to them and what's going to be inspired by the weather, whatever. And that was the difference we saw between how people were reacting to what they saw and the people who were on the street enjoying themselves and not really thinking or worrying too much about the you know, they're probably not sitting down looking at the figures or reading anything in depth around it, because that's just not, you know, their lives or their experience. And that exact thing, God, that was so good, whoever wrote that text, well done, about that idea of the envisaged of an outdoor summer being with our waterproof backed, I will say, plastic blankets, I'm sure, as well, you know, from Marks and Spencer's and whatnot.
A nice bottle of Chablis.
But the problem with that is on one side of it, it's unempathetic. But the actual reality of it is it's bloody reckless, because what we're not doing is actually looking and going, this isn't our experience as the decision makers.
Okay.
So decision makers need to get better advice and more input on what actually is happening out there.
Yeah,
just so
that
it's like
a little bit more in touch, maybe,
exactly,
with people who are not
and
like
make plans
them, which
for
we all need at times.
Yeah.
Luke, you wanted to talk about Wuhan. You picked out a couple of pieces there. Can I ask you something first? Because I do feel this is floating around with people, and I'm surprised the number of people who are queuing up to get a vaccine themselves, who are feeling slightly differently about getting their kids vaccinated. What are your thoughts? Can you understand why these people who are not anti-vaxxers, not hesitant at all themselves, but suddenly they're thinking,
it's a complicated one. Yeah. Why would you vaccinate a child who's at very low risk of a disease? You start with that, because children do very well, thankfully, with this disease. The reason to vaccinate them is to get rid of the virus. In other words, the transmission thing is lowered if we vaccinate as many people as possible. The other argument we have is the developing world needs vaccines desperately, and there's loads of vulnerable people still in India and all over the place. Why wouldn't we give our excess supply to them and wait till later to vaccinate the children is one debate that we're having. But both sides are there. That's going to go back and forth a bit, I think, between people, different opinions on it.
Yeah, so you think there's probably going to be a big conversation around
there is,
that. Is it not going to, probably not going to happen for a while?
No,
anyway.
I'd wait anyway. In my view, I would over 18s is fine, and then give any excess supply for a while to countries that really need it. There's loads of healthcare workers unvaccinated in these countries.
Okay, makes sense. Now, Wuhan, and I mean, it's a small little corner there in the front of the Sunday Times, but this, I think this, it keeps coming back, and it's a massive story in a way, like. So just tell us what the story is and where it's at, and what are your thoughts?
Well, we still don't know where this virus came from, which sounds a bit unusual given that we've known about it now for a year and a half. And the WHO went in and tried to find out, and they came back and said probably from an animal, a bat, into a human in the wild was the idea. But now the US administration, and then the UK, in fact, they want a proper inquiry into this and try to find out, was it in a lab?
Yeah.
So the idea here
is... WHO inquiry, we are slightly setting aside, yeah.
Slightly, yes. Yeah. It came back with, we don't know, I suppose, is the answer. But what's happened is, Ben, there's a report now that's reasonably accurate. I think three people in November from the Wuhan Institute of Virology who were working on coronaviruses ended up in hospital with a flu-like disease. So the question
In 2019
now this is, by the way. So the question is, did they pick up the virus in the lab is the question, and was it an accident, basically? So there's a chance of that. You'd have to be reasonable. There's a slim chance of that. Or was it picked up in the wild in a wet market or out in the countryside or whatever?
So somebody's minor cock-up at work could have changed the whole course of the history of the world.
Well, that's the worry. It's very important to find out. If it was a lab accident, we're less worried about another pandemic.
Okay.
You know? Let's go that way. Accidents are rare.
Fair play to you, Luke.
Yes, it's true.
You've only optimistic spin on that one. Jim, you were looking at that too.
Yeah, I was looking at it. I mean, the Wuhan Institute of Virology was conducting research on bat-derived coronaviruses. So, you know, I presume there's nothing inherently wrong about that. It's a positive thing to be doing as a top institute.
Yeah.
Obviously, if this is the case, it managed to get out and create all these sorts of problems.
But I suppose the issue is we're not blaming them for doing that, but the issue is
how they dealt with it. There is a big issue around that, and I guess it'll be very difficult to get the truth of that. But there's also, it's important, I think, to put this in a global geopolitical context.
Yeah, go on.
I mean, if you look at what Trump's policy towards China was, Biden has taken on the baton. There is a very, very combative approach to China, particularly from the United States, increasingly from Europe. So there's a lot of politics going on here as well.
Do you think we shouldn't be combative with China? Should we appease China a bit more?
No, I think we have to. You know, China has to be taken on because a lot of the practices out of China are not practices that would be tolerated in the States or in Europe, for example. So I think a robust approach, particularly in areas like intellectual property rights and so on, you know, China has to be controlled like everybody else. It has to be subject to the same sorts of rules. But I think this whole story has to be seen in that context as well. And I just wonder, I was wondering, and Luke has sort of answered the question for me, you know, so what? Why are they intent on finding out where it came from? You know, it came from somewhere, but Luke started saying that if we know it came out of a lab, it's much more positive than if it just evolved naturally in nature.
And Jim, let's take it back to parochial problems. Now, you picked out a piece in the Mail on Sunday by John Drennan and Valerie Hanley, Crackdown on PUP Economy.
Yeah, there is a growing story, and I got a text about this about 3 weeks ago after doing a podcast from a hotelier in Killarney, was saying to me that he was having serious difficulty trying to rehire workers as he prepares to reopen. And we had stories last week from the hairdressing sector, for example, saying that they were having serious difficulty in trying to get people back to work. And one chain in Dublin has had to turn away 40% of its customers because it can't get the staff. And Adrian Cummins in the Restaurant Association is quoting a few articles today saying that restaurants are struggling to rehire staff. And one of the reasons maybe that a lot of people have just left. Okay.
Yeah, apparently a lot of hospitality staff have gone to the UK.
They've gone to the UK.
And then a lot of them have got out of the game as well. Because why was they living this precarious existence?
Yes, they have indeed. There is an aspect of that. But the second piece then would be the incentive to go back to work if you're getting €350 a week on the pandemic unemployment payment. And that is a challenge. The government is launching its National Economic Recovery Plan on Tuesday of this week, I believe. And a key part of that will have to be how they're going to wind down the PUP and the other business COVID-related payments.
Which we're told will start happening September, October. Yes, students maybe will get it for the summer, but not then in September. Leo Varadkar was very clear the other night, again, at that press conference after the big announcement, that they're not getting the evidence of people refusing to come back to work because they're comfortable on the PUP.
Because it's anecdotal. And I think that's fair enough for him to say. But there is
a mechanism where employers can complain, isn't it, to the Department of Social Welfare or alert them. And those complaints don't seem to be coming through.
So this is the thing between who's actually saying that this is a huge problem and who isn't. And I don't doubt, actually, that there are some people who are looking at their lives in a way that you've explained there. And also some people who are just like, it's currently €350. But that is going to go down, right? So this is not going to be, I would think, a long-term problem. But for me, it can also be a symptom of how it has been to be in one of those jobs up to this point. If you're not massively well paid in a situation where we have no access to housing at a reasonable level, and I think that's across the country, that's not even an urban problem anymore, then I think like this is a symptom of it. And I think we have to be a little bit careful. I was looking at that Mail piece this morning as well, and the piece itself was very solid from John and Valerie. The headline on it, Crackdown on PUP Economy. We have to watch our language. I think it's going to get very divisive in that way. And that the PUP is acting as a disincentive to work is a very generalised way of looking at it. And certainly the anecdotes that we've been hearing are things like, you know, hairdressers not wanting to go back to work, but then you see them pop up on Instagram.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's quite PUP. That's like a cash economy there.
Exactly, but that they're on the PUP, but they're doing the black economy jobs on top. So you get the PUP and then you get a few things. But if you were to look at the actual figures then in terms of people who were paid the PUP last week, like only 9% were actually hairdressers and beauticians. So just, you know, we have to be a bit proportionate about the response.
Oh yeah, but like 9% were hairdressers and beauticians. Hairdressers and beauticians are all supposed to be gone back to work.
Yeah.
Well, so the fact that 9% of them are hairdressers and beauticians would make you wonder. That's all.
But they're not everybody was able to open the doors like that either, you know, and some businesses closed down. So there's, you know, there's all of this kind of thing. So I just think that it is something they have to look at, but they have to look at the wider thing of what choices people made. The one more thing I'll say about it is that people have not been in amber for the last year or even for the last lockdown.
Yeah.
Like you're basically saying that people should have been, not you, Brandon, but that people should have been waiting to hop back in. Their circumstances might have changed. They may have moved, as you said.
Absolutely.
Country,
Susan,
counties.
I just want to let Jim in quickly on that before we go to a break.
There's anecdotal evidence on the PUP, but there's also the government looked at what it reopened and it estimated what sort of decline should see in the PUP, and it didn't decline by as much as they would have expected given what's
25,000 doesn't seem a lot to have signed off last week, but they are saying it'll be 25,000 a week.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think second piece, finally, Brendan, is that it is really necessary for businesses to be supported as long as possible, because there's a huge legacy of debt left after the last 12 or 18 months, and that's why these bullet payments and so on are going to be so necessary for those businesses to actually open up and survive, more importantly.
Okay. Luke, just to wind us down into the real world now, for we have a few minutes left. You picked a piece here, and like this is probably more relevant to most of our lives now than in a funny way than a lot of what we've been talking about. Exercise. I think a lot of people are doing a lot more exercise. You've picked a piece in the Sunday Times by Nicholas Helen, and it's about tennis. We should all be playing tennis.
Yeah, well, we know exercise is good for us. We know that, Brendan, don't we? We've heard that all the time. The International Longevity Centre in the UK, big analysis. If you play tennis, you live 9.7 years longer. So there you have it. There's one reason to play tennis. If you play badminton, it's 6.1 years. Football, 4.7 years. Cycling, 3.7. Jim cycled in this morning, by the way. He can expect to live 3.7 years longer.
Where did you cycle from this morning, Jim?
Ternure.
Okay, I thought it was Waterford for a minute.
There.
And listen, Luke, do we know that? You'd be a man for research and cause and effect and all that thing. It could be that tennis players are generally better living people, couldn't it?
They might, but that's a confounding variable.
Is that what we call that?
But it's across sports, different sports, but it's fantastic. And any exercise is good for you, basically. Yeah. This really shows it, and you can live a lot longer if you take regular exercise. These people are playing tennis like once and twice a week, I guess.
They didn't do hurling.
Yeah, that's right. Although I suspect that's good.
I think you live a shorter life.
I think you're hurling a lot.
Luke, this is stating the beaten obvious now, but just to say it to be clear, I was reading another piece during the week saying that basically if exercise was a medicine, if Big Pharma had it, it'd be a no-brainer. The benefits are so incredible.
And the data is fantastic. Three times a week, right, get your heart rate up for 30 minutes in three sessions. Now, that's not go for a walk or do your gardening. Just get the heart rate up.
Yeah.
The blood is surging around your body. Your immune system loves it, of course, and great for your immune system exercise. So the evidence has always been there. But you're right, exercise is the best medicine potentially.
Luke, can I ask you a question? Was there any data there about how many years going jogging takes? Because honestly, every time I go for a jog, I think it takes about 6 months off my life. So
that's right. Yeah, high impact is about you. That's the advice.
Oh, right.
Regular, steady exercise is the best.
And Susan, are you one of these people who took up jogging over the course of the pandemic, or are you long time runner?
Well, I love cycling as well. Hashtag and a cyclist and all that. But with two kids, when they're small, it's kind of hard to fit that stuff in. And it's easy to make excuses. So the first lockdown, I was absolutely drinking through in the week, all that kind of stuff. Much better this year. And I had to set myself a goal. So in March, I did a 21-day sort of challenge around 5K a day for Down Syndrome Ireland to raise some funds, because a lot of charities haven't done well in the pandemic.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
a lot of their normal events, fundraising events, didn't happen. So the Purple Run for DSI didn't happen. So I did that. And it kind of kept it up a little bit. Not every day, but it was definitely the thing. I needed something to set myself some goal, because I wouldn't have done it by myself. It's really hard, you know. I mean, we kind of all know this.
Yeah.
But the reality is different.
Oh no, running is crap. Like, I mean, I do it, but it's
my wife thought I had gone a little
briefly,
bit
Jim,
portly during COVID, so she got me a turbo trainer for my racing bike for my birthday. So. That's okay. Another option.
You were very passive aggressive. here's a present. Cough yourself on. Okay, listen, that's all we've time for. Thank you very much, Professor Luke O'Neill, Susan Daly of the Journal.ie, and Jim Power, economist.